Welcome to the 20th episode of The Lucid Truth with Dr. Amesh Adalsha, Senior Scholar of the Infectious Diseases Division of Johns Hopkins University Center of Health Security. His focus is on preparing for pandemics much worse than this one, as in an apocalypse-type event. So he shares some optimism when it comes to the light at the end of the tunnel here. We will get through this, and we can use it as an opportunity to be more prepared if this were to happen again under worse conditions. This is only a 20-minute conversation, so it's very concise. We get right to it. So, please welcome Dr. Amesh Adalsha. What are your thoughts on how everything's going right now? Because I listened to your interview with Sam Harris, and I liked how your perspective was a little more balanced than some of what other people are saying. So what are your current thoughts?
I do think that this outbreak is going to be remembered as something where many bad decisions were made that created a situation that didn't have to be. And we are in the situation that we're in today because of a lack of interest in pandemic preparedness and an inability to really think of this virus as something that was going to be able to spread efficiently throughout the United States. And now we're left with very blunt instruments such as social distancing that have become the real tool that's being used by governors across the country to try and control this in an effort to really preserve hospital capacity. So I don't give the United States good marks on how this has been handled. I think looking back at H1N1, it was handled much, much better. Even Ebola was handled much, much better. Obviously, this is different in scope, but it's very predictable what has happened here. And it's not something that we thought would really... We knew that there were going to be hiccups in our pandemic response. I don't think many people thought that our diagnostic testing and narrowly strict criteria for testing would have basically put us in a situation where we have hospitals that are on the brink of crisis in some parts of the country.
Yeah, it seems like we could have been more prepared for this. Do you still view this as a kind of dress rehearsal for if things were to be worse or when they will be in the future?
I do think that when you look at this coronavirus and its case fatality ratio, which probably ranges, you know, around 0.66 according to the models, if you account for the severity bias in the data, but grant even if you take it up to 1%, this virus isn't something that has a case fatality ratio like avian influenza. And I do think that the fact that we are faltering so much with something with a case fatality ratio of 1% or less really shows that we have a lot of work to do if we're going to be able to meet a challenge like avian influenza in the future. So even though I thought initially that this was a dress rehearsal, I think we've done it so badly that I'm now questioning our ability to handle something much more severe. And this could have been a dress rehearsal if it was handled better. But I think that because of early mistakes that were made that compounded and cascaded, we were left with basically a pandemic that has become extremely challenging to control and has led to major disruptions, more so than we estimated, I think, in the beginning from something that would have this type of a case fatality ratio.
So what do you think some of the key mishaps were at first that we can use to better adjust our response in the future so that next time we actually are prepared to respond appropriately?
The biggest mishap has to do with the fact that when the initial cases were reported in China, and we understood that there had been cases that were going on at least in November and maybe earlier, and we knew that this was a respiratory virus that spread efficiently from person to person, that this was not something that was going to be containable. And the fact is, by the time we took notice of it in January, it had already had a 2-month head start. And if you give a virus like that a 2-month head start, it's going to be everywhere. You're not going to know which countries have it and which countries don't. So if you narrowly restrict testing criteria to those who had traveled to China in the last 14 days, and also make it very difficult to order tests on people with mild illness, meaning no lower respiratory tract involvement, just maybe having a sore throat or a fever by itself. That makes it impossible to actually find and diagnose cases. And those patients who didn't get diagnosed or didn't get tested are contagious, possibly even more contagious than those who get hospitalized. And that allowed basically transmission chains to be set up that went throughout the United States by the time and really were kind of festering until they boiled over in Washington State and we realized what was going on. So I really think that the failure here had to do with imagining this as a China-only disease and then restricting testing, being too focused on keeping the numbers down or thinking using those numbers as a scoreboard, saying, oh, there's 12 cases now and it's going to go down to zero, for example, or something like that. That type of approach was never going to be something tenable for a virus that we knew could spread efficiently and that we always knew that the 12 cases were likely an underrepresentation because of the way our testing was constrained. And I think that's the biggest mistake that we had. And then there was the follow-on of the bureaucratic issues that came about when a public health emergency was declared, which made it paradoxically harder for diagnostic companies and state health labs and university labs to be able to make their own tests. And we were left with basically the CDC running all the tests, which created a tremendous backlog and lag time, which we're not even still recovered from. So I do think that's another major issue. And then I would say the politicization of this pandemic, and every infectious disease gets politicized, but the politicization of this outbreak has been, I think, really detrimental to the response efforts, where you have people pitting politicians against physicians, and when you have blue state governors doing one thing and red state governors doing another thing, all of that has made it something that is that's really made it much harder to respond to this outbreak. And I think these are all things that we sort of knew were out there that could happen, but seeing them all come to fruition after we predicted this and many reports that people in the field have written for decades, it's really eye-opening to see how much progress we need to make in pandemic preparedness.
So in terms of the political response, recently Dr. Paul Offit was on this show, and he's an expert in infectious diseases as well, and he thinks that we are being too proactive in terms of our closing. Other people are saying that we're not being proactive enough. So what do you think in terms of the difference with reactive closings, where the virus has already infected your region, and proactive closings?
These are difficult decisions. And what you ideally want to do is have a very surgical, precise type of social distancing measure in place based on the local transmission dynamics of the virus in your area and your hospital capacity in the area. However, because our diagnostic testing was so bad, we had no idea where it was, where it wasn't, where people were on their epidemic curves, and governors were left with a very blunt tool. I do think it's really important that people, when they're thinking about closures, also think about the downstream consequences in terms of what's going to happen to other health conditions that are now going to be left to linger because they might be considered quote-unquote elective by a hospital. What's going to happen to people who lose their jobs and can't pay their mortgage or can't afford food? All of those are costs, and you have to weigh those costs when you make economic shutdown decisions. And I think that's an important part to have in this discussion, and that there needs to be more of a middle way and moving away from a false alternative of letting the virus basically run rampant and overrun our hospitals and put them into crisis versus a Wuhan-style lockdown where people's individual rights are violated and they're unable to actually provide for their own basic needs. So I do think that we want to get to a point where this is able to be done. However, the tools aren't there. And the time that we had when we didn't have such a burden of cases was squandered by really backwards testing protocols.
Yeah, it seems like there's not much of a balanced discussion here, because if you speak about the economic side, it's if you don't care about the virus, when both are things that need to be weighed and taken into consideration. So how long do you think things are going to last? Because there's a lot of speculation going on about the length of time that the virus will run its course, that stay-at-home orders will be in place. What's your thoughts on that?
I do think that everything is going to be premised on what happens in New York City. I think that is a good way to view this outbreak, looking at that as the canary in the coal mine, where they have a high burden of infections, where their hospitals are really under immense surge stress, if those hospitals can make it through here without, through the next several days without going into crisis, without having to ration ventilators, I think it will be important. It will be an important marker and milestone for other locales of what may, what they can expect, because I think the intensity is going to be the highest in New York City, anywhere in versus anywhere else in this country. So I do think once that happens, you may start seeing people think about taking a more nuanced approach and understanding what puts people at risk, what doesn't put people at risk, and you may see modified rules for certain businesses to open. I think mass gatherings are still going to be something that is not going to be feasible until there's a vaccine or a change in the risk perception of this virus. But I do think that you're going to probably see throughout this month basically the same type of pattern, and then maybe in May you'll start to see some lifting if everything goes okay in terms of no hospital going into crisis and we get better at diagnosing patients, that health departments feel adequately resourced in order to do contact tracing, and we have enough mechanical ventilators and personal protective equipment to take care of our healthcare workers and the patients from the mechanical ventilators.
Okay, so no mass gatherings until a vaccine. What do you think about the time frame for the development of a vaccine? Do you think it's about a year to 18 months? And do you think that the mutation of the virus will make vaccination a problem like influenza?
I think the best case scenario is a year to 18 months. It's important to remember that. So if everything goes perfectly, it could be longer than 18 months. Vaccine development is usually measured in years and decades, not in months. So I think we have to keep that in mind, that the first wave of this virus is going to be fought without a vaccine. I don't believe that the coronavirus is going to pose a challenge in terms of vaccination with mutations. This is a virus that doesn't mutate that much, that we have precedence with animal coronavirus vaccines. So I do think this is going to be hopefully a vaccine that's more on this, more like the measles vaccine than the influenza vaccine.
Great. Thankfully, Dr. Offit shared your sentiment with that, and he specializes in vaccines, so there was some concern about the mutation with that. So how do you think we frame this in the perspective of this could have been the apocalypse, but it's not. So we can use this to prepare for if it were an apocalypse. So in terms of doing better next time, do you think we should encourage the National Pandemic Response Team better, which was cut in 2018? Maybe have more hospital beds. We only have 2.8 per 1,000 people. What do you think about that?
I do think that there needs to be high level involvement in pandemic preparedness, and that means the White House level, that this has to be considered part of national security and not something that goes through this cycle of panic and neglect where people panic during an outbreak or an epidemic and then it disappears. This needs to be something that is a priority for the federal government and should be thought of in the same way we think of other threats that the Department of Defense, for example, deals with, and it should be funded appropriately that way in a sustainable manner. I do think that that there has to be much more recognition that our hospitals are a core national security asset when it comes to these types of emergencies, and there has to be funding for hospital preparedness. And hospital leaders themselves should think of their emergency preparedness divisions as a core part of their business and not something that they can only worry about during emergency situations. And there needs to be a thought about what our capacity is. Do we have the ability to have alternative care sites? Can we rapidly absorb surge? And I think that's something that's gone not really prioritized by hospitals, because hospitals try to basically have their beds occupied as full as possible all the time, because they're almost like a hotel in that sense, that they're getting paid based on if their beds are occupied or not. So I think that there are some there's going to have to be some way to think about hospital preparedness in a manner that moves beyond just thinking of our hospitals as in the manner of just having the beds occupied and having them as full as possible all the time, like a hotel.
Right. So what, in terms of panic, what do you think about that? Because it seems like there, if you're too panicked, that hospitals could be overrun with people who are unnecessarily worried, and also can contribute to cortisol, stress, all those negative things, maybe even heart attacks. But if you're not worried enough, maybe you won't be listening to social distancing recommendations and that kind of thing. What do you think the balance is in terms of being realistically afraid of this virus and what it can do, but also being able to manage yourself and not be kind of overrun by it?
It's a fine line between panic and being very proactive. And I think it's important to be able to take real steps to ensure your safety and to be aware of the threats that you might face from this virus or any other virus. But I don't think that panic is helpful to anybody. And I think that having an understanding of what's going on, being plugged into your local sources of news, your local health department, your local healthcare facilities, understanding what preparations are being taken should decrease your panic. It's hard when you're in a 24/7 news cycle with a lot of social media. There's many different things you'll be exposed to that are basically designed to incite panic, and it's hard to separate all of them out. But I do think you can do it if you actually look for trusted sources of information and engage with the local process that's going on in your community. And that, I think, will give you something to channel your energy into and make you less likely to be panicked, because you'll understand what's going on at the most local level.
Okay, so since we're running out of time, I just have one more question for you. Do you think that because everybody has this salient threat on their minds, that this is possible to get people more serious about the threats that pandemics can offer? And were a more serious pandemic to occur now, we would be more ready for it, because now we know that this is serious.
I do think that it's going to be some time before people forget this experience. And I do think there is an opportunity now to fortify our pandemic preparedness so that we are prepared for the next pandemic, even though this one is just in its beginning stages. But this really drives home many of the points that all of us in this community have been talking about for decades and have really been ignored. I think this really shows that this was something that was predictable and it was completely preventable.
Great. Well, thank you for your time. Is there anything else that you think would be of value to listeners that's come up in recent events?
No, I think everybody should keep their eyes on New York City and see what happens in the next couple of days.
Awesome. Well, we will be paying attention. Thank you for your time.
All right. Bye.
I thought that was both a realistic and positive update from Dr. Adalsha. You can find more about him on the Johns Hopkins University website, and find more interviews with him on other podcasts. Recently, he was on Making Sense with Sam Harris. If you enjoy the podcast, you can share it with your friends, bring it up during a conversation, talk about it on social media, or support it on Patreon. As always, thank you for listening. And I hope to see you for the next episode of The Lucid Truth.